Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Chris Sitterick. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Boston Mayor Marty Walsh wants a full accounting after a bribery scandal involving the Zoning Board of Appeals.
So we're going to have them take a deep review and deep look at this particular situation, but also other situations, and come back with some, not recommendations, but some back with what they see might be some issues that we have to deal with.
We'll get one city councilor's reaction. Also today, Suffolk District Attorney Rachel Rollins came in with a reform agenda. Now a municipal court judge has rejected routine motions from her prosecutors. The case may land in the state's highest court. We'll get the latest and ask, what's behind all the drama? And
we didn't stop it.
Stephen King's It returns this weekend. What is it we love so much about Stephen King's stories?
When people look back 100 years from now, they'll see King as one of the writers who was able to garner the pulse of American culture.
That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Chris Sitterick. Boston Mayor Marty Walsh ordered an independent review of the city's Zoning Board of Appeals process earlier today. That comes after a former city official admitted to accepting $50,000 in bribes in exchange for influencing a member of that board. Here's Mayor Walsh speaking with reporters this morning.
So we're going to have them take a deep review and deep look at this particular situation, but also other situations, and come back with some, not recommendations, but some back with what they see might be some issues that we have to deal with.
Boston City Councilor Michelle Wu joins me now in Studio 3 to talk about this developing story and other issues facing the city of Boston. Councilor Wu, thanks so much for being here.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
So let's start there. Mayor Marty Walsh announced today that he's ordering this independent investigation of the city's Zoning Board of Appeals. Is that the right step forward for the city?
You know, I think we have much more immediate issues to deal with. It's always great for the city to be taking stock of how our processes are working and to be looking at best practices and ways to improve that. But we have a case where someone has pleaded guilty to bribery, claiming that he influenced a member of the ZBA. The board is scheduled to meet again on Tuesday, and currently the integrity of the entire board is in question. So I think we need some quick information. Who was involved? Which ZBA board member? Were there multiple of them? What was their involvement? And once that is identified, that person or those people should be asked to recuse themselves from any votes until a further investigation is done.
So you'd like to see no more action from the Zoning Board of Appeals until that information comes forward?
I'm not saying that we should slow down city business, and certainly there is a lot on the agenda. I've seen the agendas. They go through so much, and the cases that are before there are homeowners and businesses and people who have been waiting for months to get resolution. It's not the fault of those people that our system is set up on these special approvals. What I'm saying is that we should be able to get answers before a couple months from now or whenever this review is done. It's a pretty simple set of conversations, just seven people that have to be talked to of, did you know this former BPDA employee who pleaded guilty? Did you have conversations with him about this particular project that was highlighted? And what was your involvement? And that information should be public.
So that's kind of the short-term concern. In terms of long-term concerns, how do we address the zoning process in Boston? Do you think that the whole system is broken? Is this a symptom of a bigger problem?
It is a symptom. You know, what's being talked about now is a look at the culture and processes of the ZBA. But we could have the most efficient, most detailed and documented processes within this same board. But if all our larger development policy is happening at this Board of Appeals level, case by case, special approval after special approval, it just leads to a system that's not transparent and driven by influence.
So how do you fix that then? What's the solution?
You know, Boston is unique because most other cities across the country have a more intense form of citywide comprehensive master planning. They create a plan that ties together transportation and housing and land use, affordability, schools, and it's updated frequently and has metrics and resources attached to it. We have some ideas and we have some general aspirations, but there are usually those planning exercises are not then incorporated back into the zoning code. So the rules and regulations remain driven by these one-off exceptions and variances.
So you said it's important for transparency to be across the board here. Isn't a comprehensive review of this process and how it works, isn't that a way towards transparency?
You know, we've had two reviews of the way development works in the last 5 years or so. And both of those reviews outlined specific steps as to what needed to be changed at the BPDA. I think there might have been cases where the ZBA was mentioned as well. But we know that development as a whole in Boston is happening very quickly. It's a very hot market. But when it's set up to be built on special exceptions and approvals, the most well-connected people end up having the best opportunities to get their projects through. That's not how it should work.
So if you want to bring all of those components together, are you talking about creating a new position? Is there a new agency? How do you accomplish bringing transportation and housing and all of those aspects under one?
We need to focus on planning.
Process.
We need to focus on community-driven and involved planning that includes all of those subjects that are our most urgent challenges now. Climate resiliency, equity, mobility, affordability. These are all issues that we have the chance to help fix through how we harness development in the city and the interest in jobs and moving here. But right now, the way that it's happening, it's actually making these issues worse.
Isn't that something that the city council could play a role in, take some leadership there?
So over time, the city council has actually had a lesser and lesser role in development. The way that our agency is set up, we have no oversight whatsoever except for confirming the members that the mayor appoints to the ZBA, as the ZBA board, as well as the Boston Planning and Development Agency board, the ones that the mayor gets to appoint. So we've exercised that power and ask hard questions at the confirmation hearings, but there really needs to be larger reforms, and I'm working on some suggestions and recommendations too.
So many of the questions around development are really locally based. I'm wondering what you think of Governor Charlie Baker's bill that he's pushing that would essentially lower the threshold for communities that are looking to change their zoning. There's a number of kind of housing-related zoning changes that would be able to be passed by a simple majority as opposed to two-thirds. Is that something you'd support?
We absolutely need to lower barriers to create housing in the entire region and across the state. We are very much in a housing crisis, and that's because there's such a shortage of affordable and workforce housing. Boston has been creating more units, but more often than not, they've been luxury units that are out of reach for residents to afford. But we also need to see cities and towns outside of Boston contributing to that, too. And so it's been great to see that there are so many partners across the region.
All right. It's been a pretty crazy week here in Boston news-wise. I want to shift gears a bit and turn to another story that's been unfolding with a development pretty much every day. On Saturday, there was the so-called Straight Pride Parade. There's been some serious criticism about police actions during that in terms of how they handled counter-protesters who were arrested. It's been a few days now to kind of see different angles of video and read accounts of folks who were there. Do you have any issues with the way police handled the situation over the weekend?
Yes, and I shared some of my thoughts over Twitter, and the beauty of social media is that it is interactive and in real time, so I've continued to hear from and learn from people who have been sharing their thoughts on all perspectives. You know, the bottom line is that what we saw on Saturday was a national event designed to intimidate, to bully, to discriminate against the LGBTQ community. And this is a community that has a history with police action and violence, particularly in riots. And we as a city and we as a country, I think, need to be much more intentional about that. What we saw, or at least what, you know, I was not able to be there, but the reports that I heard from people who did attend and the footage that I was able to see did show that there were so many police there, many units from outside Boston, paramilitary units with full riot gear, armored vehicles from outside the city coming in. That immediately, this militarization of police efforts, particularly at a large-scale event, particularly at this large-scale event, immediately sets the tone for conflict and escalation. And, you know, I think there are some serious questions about use of force, and particularly many, many videos of the pepper spraying, which involved not all of the officers, but in particular, one officer has been pointed out on social media. And so I think there are many more questions about how we ensure that decisions like this are happening in the right way to promote public safety at future events, because this next year will be quite busy as well.
So to that public safety component, we did speak with Mayor Walsh on the show on Tuesday about his thoughts on how the police handled the event Saturday. Here's what he said.
It's a very difficult balance, a dedicated balance, and I think that, you know, my goal was to make sure that no one was seriously hurt on Saturday, and so as far as that, we got it right. A lot of folks turned on the police, too, because they couldn't get to the Straight Pride parade, and I think that's unfortunate.
So he reemphasized a couple of times that no one was seriously injured, so therefore he felt it was a success. Is that a fair assessment?
Looking back, it's easy to make judgments about what the decision should have been and how we ended up here. You know, I think there's a larger and separate question about whether the permits should have been granted in this way to begin with, knowing that this was an event put on by this particular group of very politically driven white supremacist, hard right organizations and organizers.
I want to pick up on that because I think that's interesting. One of your city council colleagues, the city council president, actually, Andrea Campbell, has called for the city to review its permitting process, specifically with regards to organizations that she says, quote, pretend to march under the guise of free speech, but instead are marching to promote hate, end quote. Would you grant a permit for the demonstration on Saturday?
There is. The importance of free speech is enshrined in our Constitution. However, the role of cities and local authorities is to make the judgment call on when public safety also needs attention. And so I think there was an argument to be made that Boston could have gone to court over this and said, you know, we are anticipating that this particular organization, this event is designed to draw violence, draw conflict, and put more specific conditions on it, or even deny the permit and have to go to court to hear those arguments out.
If you were the mayor, would you have done that?
You know, I think looking back at the event and how it unfolded, what's important is to center on the experiences of people who were there on the ground. I have heard from officers, I have heard from people who were there as part of the counter-protest that we need to do better as a city, and this will be an ongoing discussion that we have to have. It's not just about looking back at this particular event, because there will be more events to come in 2020. And given the agenda of the person in the White House right now, and I think Boston wants to be the example of how we don't have to have a conflict between public safety and public health and community and celebrating the vibrancy, the love that's possible in our city.
It's a tough line to draw, obviously, where free speech, where you're saying this is now a threat to public safety and therefore not protected under free speech. I spoke pretty strongly against the group putting this on, but I'm curious, would you say that that the city should have fought this?
I think that the city's right is always to stand up for our values. Certainly, we cannot be controlling, selectively denying who gets to speak up and who doesn't get to speak up. But when it's clear that there is a conflict with our values, and there's a conflict with the group that this event was designed to terrorize and intimidate, Boston should stand up and fight. I think we've seen, for example, with Airbnb, that when we go to court, when we take on the fights that we're told we shouldn't have and we will certainly lose, that the city actually has tremendous power and can make a big statement in the process.
I mentioned this has been a pretty crazy week news-wise. That story didn't end after the weekend. Some of the counter-protesters were arraigned this week, and Boston Municipal Court Judge Richard Sinnott refused prosecutors' motions to dismiss some of the low-level charges, disorderly conduct, resisting arrest, something that Suffolk County DA Rachel Rollins made a part of her platform when she was running. A lot of folks have said this is a personal rebuke of those policies. What's your reaction to how this has played out in Boston Municipal Court?
I agree. I mean, the role of our system our system sets up separate roles for checks and balances. And the role of the prosecutor is to exercise prosecutorial discretion. And in fact, this particular prosecutor, our district attorney, ran and earned a mandate through popular vote for an agenda of criminal justice reform. So she has been very clear about her intentions and her goals since she began her candidacy. So now to see the judge inserting a little bit of personal opinion into that when the law and the separation of powers defines it this way is very troubling.
We spoke with our legal analyst, retired federal judge Nancy Gertner, about this. She called the judge's actions lawless and said that he could potentially be impeached over this. Do you think it would be appropriate to remove him from the bench?
You know, I know that there's a lot that we can do on the city council, and I'm going to focus on our efforts to stand up and be legislators and continue to draw attention and support the actions that both the district attorney and fierce, brave attorneys like Susan Church are taking on. There are so many battles to be fought right now, and I completely back our DA's actions and want to make sure that we are not just focusing on this particular instance, but on the injustices and the continual assaults that are happening on people's rights across so many different communities.
Yeah, you mentioned Susan Church. She's actually going to be coming up next. Our time's running out quickly, but I just want to ask you before you go, you mentioned the Airbnb agreement. That's an issue you've been very outspoken of. Do you feel that the city got everything that it needed to get? And do you have any other concerns about short-term rentals in Boston?
The settlement is a tremendous victory for the city. It gives us the ability to enforce, with Airbnb agreeing to take responsibility and helping enforce the laws. And I think it's another example of why it matters to have a city council and city that stands up for people. The only reason we were able to get the settlement is because the court backed up a key provision of our ordinance that we were told probably we would lose in a lawsuit. But that didn't happen. And because of that, we were able to negotiate what will be one of the strongest set of protections for protecting our housing stock in this across the country.
That's Boston City Councilor Michelle Wu. Councilor Wu, thanks so much for the time.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, the latest in a Boston Municipal Court judge's pushback against Suffolk District Attorney Rachel Rollins. The aforementioned Susan Church will be in studio. I'm Chris Siderick. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Chris Siderick. And the quote of the day could very well be an unconstitutional abuse of his power. That's from Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins. And the his she's referring to is Boston Municipal Court Judge Richard Sinnott. Judge Sinnott this week denied motions from Rollins prosecutors to dismiss some low-level charges against counter-protesters that were arrested at Saturday's Straight Pride Parade. Rollins has now filed an emergency petition with the state's Supreme Judicial Court to overturn the judge's ruling. And if that's not enough drama for you, there was another turn yesterday when Judge Sinnott had prominent immigration and criminal defense attorney Susan Church taken into custody for contempt of court. Church was defending some of the counter-protesters who were arrested. And she joins us now in the studio to talk about what's happened and what comes next. Susan Church, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And we should note that we reached out to Judge Sinnott for comment today, but he has declined. So you have had a busy 24 hours. Take us back to yesterday. What happened?
I can't even – it's so surreal to me. It's something that I just cannot believe happened. So I was there. I was the lead attorney that day for the protesters who were – some of them were – none of them were getting arraigned, actually, except for two. And my – I walked into the courtroom, and the judge was already hearing my client's case, which I was – because we are assigned individual clients. We don't do mass representation that way. And I was kind of – surprised, like why my appearance isn't on the case. They should have known that I was going to be there. The district attorney is trying to say that they have a legal right to null pros, which they absolutely unequivocally do. I then was asking to speak because he wasn't giving me an opportunity to speak. He finally let me. I think seconds must have gone by. I don't think it was very long. It didn't feel very long to me. I said, I just need you to let me read you the case that's exactly on point, binding precedent. There's no way around this case. And he said, I'm pretty sure he said, I'm warning you. And I turn around and I'm in handcuffs. Like, and it was so surreal. Like, I didn't raise my voice. I didn't use foul language. I wasn't, you know, getting the courtroom to cheer. And I think it's important to know that, like, I've had fights with judges before. And maybe the worst thing that's ever happened is that you're asked to sit in the courtroom and they'll call other cases until both of you kind of cool off, right? You don't arrest a person. It's the first time in my life. I've never been in handcuffs before. And, you know, it was just extraordinary.
He went on to say the reason was because you were talking over him.
Yeah.
How common is that in courtrooms for attorneys and judges?
I mean, if I had a dime, I would be I just did it to you. See, sorry about that. Now I'm so self-conscious about any time I talk over
somebody. I'm not going to put you in cuffs.
It's like, My husband's like, nothing new here, you know. But it is very common because you do have limited time to make your arguments, especially in district court. You are legally required as a lawyer to preserve the record. If I don't make the proper legal arguments, my client's rights are lost. So it is important that I say at least the law that I'm relying on so I can appeal him. And yet he wasn't allowing me to do that. And it is – if lawyers were in handcuffs every day for interrupting each other, we'd have no lawyers.
So this all stems from the tension over the judge's decision not to accept the motion to dismiss from the prosecutors.
No, this is really important to understand. My client was a null pros, which is different than a motion to dismiss.
I'm speaking to the arraignments from the day before.
The day before, right. Yeah,
right.
Sorry.
And so actually we talked to Professor Chris Dearborn from Suffolk University Law School, and he actually drove home that distinction you're talking about.
He's definitely within his legal rights to deny a request for a dismissal. Whether you agree with the use of discretion or not, that is absolutely and fundamentally his right as a member of the judiciary. With the null pros, I think Rachel Rollins' office has the better of the argument. A judge cannot reject a null pros. A prosecutor has the right to end a case through that mechanism at any time of the case they want without judicial oversight.
So for those of us who are operating outside of the legal system here, watching this unfold, what happened with Tuesday's motions and why this kind of confusion about filing a motion to dismiss versus the null pros?
So Rachel Rollins has now filed what's called a 211-3 petition in front of the Supreme Judicial Court on the Tuesday cases. Both of those are null pros cases. Both of those are cases they wished to null pros and they were denied to null pros them. My case was also a null pros case. I do think that maybe you could make a distinction between a motion to dismiss versus a null pros, but I think that there's case law suggesting both. The null pros, though, is unequivocally clear. I think I was on with a prosecutor. Everyone agrees null pros is their prerogative.
So your response to what happened yesterday was, I want to quote something you told reporters, this is a highly inappropriate behavior by the judge. This was not legal and should not be let to stand. Are you pursuing any further actions after yesterday?
I'm certainly investigating other actions. I think what's important to understand in this case is imagine what happens to all the other people who are before this judge who don't have an army of lawyers, the ACLU. My husband's a criminal defense lawyer. He used to be chair of MACDL. He came. Like, I literally had so many people trying to help me that the court officers had to bar lawyers from going downstairs. What happens in that courtroom when the media is not there, when poor defendants are in front of this judge, when young lawyers just walk in? What happens then? And that's why I think things need to be investigated, and what happened to me is certainly symbolic and emblematic of much bigger problems with this judge.
Do you think that what happened to you could have an impact on other attorneys?
That's what my fear is, right? We should not be giving up this fight. This is a fight for the civil rights of human beings. This is a right. I have a lot of empathy for my clients to begin with, but I really do now. Getting ripped out of your day, being locked up, being put in handcuffs, these attorneys have to understand it is very hard to be a criminal defendant. It's very challenging. It's terrifying. And I think that we need to make sure that they're not afraid to advocate for these clients.
All right. Attorney Susan Church, hang with us for just a moment. I want to bring in another voice on this to give us some national perspective here. And to do that, we're joined by journalist and author Emily Bazelon. Her latest book is Charged, The Movement to Transform American Prosecution and End Mass Incarceration. She joins us now via Skype. Emily, hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. You're on the phone, sorry. All week, the conversation we've been hearing around these parts is how unprecedented all of this is, pretty much. What do you think of the actions taken by Judge Sinnott and everything that's gone on in this story?
I think it's unprecedented. I think what we're seeing here is pushback against a prosecutor using her discretion to decline to prosecute. So we've had prosecutors amassing more and more power in this country since the 80s, mainly as a result of having more mandatory minimum sentences, because once you have a mandatory sentence, you're really baking the punishment into the charge and the plea bargaining choice, and those are choices that prosecutors control. Okay, so now the voters in Boston chose Rachel Rollins, who wants to not use her discretion so much to ratchet up punishment, but to use resources in a way that she thinks is more wise. And in this case, she's declining to prosecute some nonviolent protesters who were charged with a minor charge of disorderly conduct, and she has a judge who doesn't want to go along with that. Well, that's not his decision.
So I want to play a quick cut from WBUR legal analyst Nancy Gertner. She's a retired federal judge. We spoke with her this week about this case, and she says that Judge Sinnott was acting outside of his legal purview.
The rule that this judge ought to have been following, if he were following any rules at all, was the rule that said that he doesn't have a role in the question of whether a prosecutor could choose to dismiss or not. A prosecutor, particularly an elected prosecutor who ran on that very policy, can't be second-guessed by the judge. The judge simply has nothing in front of him to rule on.
So, Emily, I want to ask you, if this is outside of the legal purview, what does that mean for the criminal justice system?
I mean, it means this judge's order should be reversed because Judge Gertner is correct. I should say that, of course, I think that because she taught me in law school, but she taught me well. And she was a judge herself, so she understands the different roles in the system. You know, judges have a lot of power when there's a trial happening, when there are motions about whether to suppress evidence. They get to basically decide sentences in a lot of cases where there are not mandatory sentences. But charging is in the hands of the prosecutor. That's how we have set up our system, and this judge is not following those rules.
I mentioned we spoke earlier to Suffolk University Law School Professor Chris Dearborn. He also talked to us about the differences in approaches to criminal justice coming from the DA's office, judges, law enforcement, all the players.
It's troubling to me that there's a perception of Rachel Rollins versus the police or Rachel Rollins versus the judges. That's not what's going on here. It's people with very different roles in the system and sometimes different approaches trying to find what is justice on a broader scale, but also what is justice on each individual case.
So I'd like you to respond to that. But first, we also heard him say earlier that he feels this was within the judge's legal power. What's your response to that? And then we can talk about kind of how the pieces all fit as a reform candidate takes the office.
Well, I would love to hear how he thinks it's in the judge's legal powers, because I just don't agree with that. I don't see how the judge gets to make this particular decision about forcing a prosecutor's office to prosecute people. In terms of the framing he was using, I mean, I would argue that the accurate framing here is change versus the status quo. Rachel Rollins was elected to be an agent of change in Boston, and when she does that, that is going to have ripple effects that other players in the system don't like. You have a criminal justice system that's been operating along certain assumptions for a long time. A lot of judges in that system are former prosecutors themselves. They have a more traditional understanding. They might not like the idea of declining to prosecute people, even though, let's just be clear, prosecutors do that every single day. They do a ton of that in this country. But in this particular case, this judge felt like this was not what he wanted to have happen, and so he tried to use his authority to stop it because he represents how things have been done until this point.
So, Emily, I mentioned you've done a lot of work with this on the national stage. I'm wondering how what's happening here compares to what's happening in other places.
There have been other instances of judges really trying to block reform-minded prosecutors. In Philadelphia, for example, the district attorney there, Larry Krasner, is a kind of Rachel Rollins-like guy, and he has had certain orders where he tried to, in the middle of the case, for example, drop charges against someone. That was a different matter because it was post-conviction, and so the judges in Pennsylvania pushed back against him, and I think they had more ground to stand on there given the stage of the case that they were talking about. So there have been some other instances of this. Another example, in Florida, a district attorney decided not to bring the death penalty at all, and the governor at the time, Rick Scott, said, hey, well, then I'm going to take all your pre-existing death penalty cases away from your office. And he actually won that fight because of a particular statute in Florida. So, again, we're seeing these arguments play out around the country. The voters pick a reform-minded prosecutor, and then the system tries to prevent that person from making change.
I mentioned there's a lot of players involved in the system. I want to touch on law enforcement's role. Larry Calderoni is the vice president of the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association. He was pretty pleased with the judge's actions. Here he is speaking at a press conference Thursday.
So I can go back years of former DAs looking to dismiss disorderly charges, which I'm sure we'll be reminded of. And this DA's office is doing the same thing, but the judge on the bench has taken a different position. We like that position. We think that these offenders that are here came here as agitators, here for a specific reason, here to create havoc.
So what I want to ask you about, Emily, is kind of the role that law enforcement can play, even with a reformed DA. Obviously, they're out on the streets. They're concerned with keeping the public safe. What kind of issues do you think a reformed DA could potentially present for law enforcement officers, and how can they reconcile that?
Well, look, we're talking about a parade in which there was what the police perceived as violence. There were protesters who were doing things who were against the law. I think 35 people were arrested. And Rachel Rollins said when she dismissed the charges against some of those people, look, we're prosecuting the people who are involved in what we think were threatening acts against the police. So she is doing what she can to be what she sees as discerning, differentiating between the people who were real threat and the people who got kind of scooped up, which is something that often happens during or after a protest. But the police here are painting with a broad brush. And I also think they've been critical of Rollins in the past. They've demanded her resignation, which is, you know, a pretty big thing to ask for someone who's been recently elected. You can see this as a kind of opportunity they had where the judge gave them a chance to criticize her.
Some of the response, you know, we've heard from listeners who have weighed in on this story is, hey, these were people who were exercising civil disobedience. There should be a punishment for them. What's your response to that?
Look, I mean, you want to know what the specific facts of all these arrests are. In general, disorderly conduct arrests are often arrests that get made when, like, there's no other real wrongdoing there, right? Like, if someone, you know, threatened a cop or resisted arrest, that's another potentially shaky one. But if somebody does something violent against a police officer, they don't just get charged with disorderly conduct. So the notion that every single person who participates in a protest should be arrested, that seems very broad to me and like a big problem with our First Amendment rights to speak and assemble.
And I just want to note, there were several police officers that were injured on Saturday. Do you think that weighs into the decisions?
I think it's really important to prosecute people if you can prove that they injured a police officer, right? Like, then you have an actual threat. I think everybody in law enforcement should take the safety of police officers very seriously.
All right, Emily, I know you were listening in earlier. We still have attorney Susan Church here with me, taken into custody yesterday for contempt of court. What did you make of what happened with Susan?
I mean, I listened to Susan speak, and she said she kind of couldn't believe it as it was happening, and it is a crazy story. I mean, judges should not be putting lawyers into handcuffs for trying to stand and speak for their clients.
I feel like I have to ask, we have a white male judge holding a woman in contempt of court. Do you think that possibly could have been a factor here?
I mean, I have no idea. That's not enough evidence for me to see a pattern, but I do see a judge appearing to abuse his power.
Susan, I think it's a great chance to bring you back in. What do you think?
I do think it was a really interesting dynamic, and it was about, I actually said to him, you're interrupting me repeatedly and preventing me from presenting my case, but you're telling me I cannot interrupt you. And I felt like there was a power dynamic there, but there always is between a judge and a lawyer. I, you know, personally feel that it was much more about his opposition to Rachel Rollins. And it's particularly important that the policeman's union spokesperson said, and he kind of hinted at many, many times. In fact, every time I've represented protesters, their charges are dismissed. Dan Connolly, a white Irish district attorney, always had these cases dismissed. Sometimes we had to fight a little bit, but ultimately all of my protest cases for over 20 years have been dismissed unless they involve violence, the exact same policy that Rachel Rollins is implementing. And yet she gets this extreme pushback, lawyers arrested, 211(3) petitions. I think that in addition to, yes, the resistance to change, there's an other feeling going on here among the police. And I'm concerned that they're then infecting the judge. He's supposed to be neutral and detached. He's supposed to follow the law. And yet he seems to be siding with the police, which is not his role.
So we know that District Attorney Rollins has filed the emergency request to the Supreme Judicial Court. How do things play out from here? What do you think?
I mean, I think the law is abundantly clear. There's a case exactly on point, Commonwealth v. Gordon. That's what I was trying to read to the judge. You know, the DA knows. I'm not a criminal defense lawyer who often like cheers on the prosecution and sits on their side and extols their virtues. But we're both right in this case, and I should have never been arrested.
And I should say again, we did reach out to Judge Sinnott. He's declined to comment. That is immigration and criminal defense attorney Susan Church. Susan, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And we're also joined by Emily Bazelon, journalist and author. Her latest book is Charge, The Movement to Transform American Prosecution and End Mass Incarceration. Emily, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Stay with us. Coming up, what is it that we love so much about Stephen King's stories? I'm Chris Sitterick. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Chris Sitterick. Buckle up. It's about to get spooky. That's because tomorrow, it's back.
If it ever comes back, we'll come back to you.
We didn't stop it.
Pennywise.
The clown. We can't let it happen again.
The highly anticipated It Chapter 2 comes out tomorrow. That's just 4 days before the release of Stephen King's 61st novel, The Institute. There's been a recent cultural renaissance of Stephen King, with the reemergence and remakes of some of his most iconic works. So we're wondering, what is it that's so attractive, so compelling, so enduring about the stories of Stephen King? Well, I asked Tony Magistrale. He's an English and film professor at the University of Vermont, and he's also written 4 books on King's works, published 3 interviews with the author, and even worked as King's research assistant in the mid-2000s, tasked with, get this, researching the history of the haunted house. He says King is part of a long and rich literary tradition.
Oh, boy. You know, he really comes at the culmination of a tradition, I think, that dates back really to the 18th century with the rise of the Gothic novel at the end of the 18th century and its reaction against the age of reason and enlightenment. And King has inherited the great weight of the Gothic novel. It's an incredibly rich tradition, especially as it's perceived in American art and American literature. And you've got enormous influential texts that I think King has responded to in various ways. The vampire tradition and Dracula, of course, and the early romantics, Polidori and Byron. The revival of the dead in Frankenstein. King has read and been extremely influenced by the horror tradition. And what he's done is allowed that tradition to kind of shape the world that he's created.
I've said you've written many books about Stephen King. Your 2009 book is titled Stephen King, America's Storyteller. What is so American about Stephen King and his writing?
Well, first of all, there's the breadth of it. An American writer who produces novels that are the size of doorstops. You know, he's got a lot to say. And more importantly, more relevant, I think, is the way in which he talks about American culture. I think when people look back on the 20th century, 100 years from now, they'll see King as one of the writers who is able in some way to garner the pulse of American culture in its last throes in the 20th century. What he writes about are subjects that are uniquely American. The idea, for example, of a country that's still trying to find its way, of a country that is saddled with issues like drug and alcohol addiction, that's still working its way through the notion of what it means to be a colossus.
It's interesting you mention late 20th century. Obviously, a lot of King's iconic work takes place in Maine. You've got Derry, which is basically Bangor, Maine, and then some other fictional towns around Maine. You know, Bangor is a town that's 90% white. I'm wondering, America's changing. Do you feel that the relevancy of King's work will change as America changes?
You know, I think King speaks to crisis issues, and he has in a number of his texts, he has worked with the idea of a changing America in terms of its racial configurations. Novels like, for example, The Shining, and even It. speak to dramatic changes that are happening in not only America but also in Bangor to a lesser extent. But I still think you're talking about a regional writer in a lot of ways. This is still a writer whose best work gets to the heart of what it is to be in small town America. Novels like Needful Things and Salem's Lot and It, these are novels that are still talking about the microcosm of small town America. It just happens to be Maine because that's where King is, but it could very easily be Ohio. It could very easily be, like Faulkner, one of his favorite writers, in Yawk-Napatopa, Mississippi.
It's really interesting because when you talk about the long-lasting influence of his work, Stephen King is an author who wasn't always taken very seriously by the horror genre, by mainstream literary critics. We found one interview with the LA Times from 1995 where he actually said, in advance of the release of the movie Dolores Claiborne, 35% of critics will slam this movie just because it's Stephen King. So he was very aware that there was a certain stigma attached to his name. Why do you think that was? Why was he dismissed?
Because he's amazingly successful. You know, a guy who sells enough books to make $57 million in a year can't be taken seriously, can he? and you know, what you have to remember, I think, is that there are two strains of Stephen King that are at work in contemporary America. The first strain is the literary strain, but there's also the cinematographic strain that's at work. His work has been responsible for the production of adaptations that have become part of the American cinematographic pantheon. And I'm thinking of films like Shawshank Redemption and The Green Mile, Stand By Me, and even, I'm sorry for this, Steve, if you're listening, The Shining.
I know he hates that one. I'm glad you mentioned Shawshank. I want to play a quick cut of that. This is the movie from 1994. You have Red, who's played by Morgan Freeman, speaking with Andy, played by Tim Robbins, about his dreams of getting out of prison and heading to Mexico.
I don't think you ought to be doing this to yourself, Andy. I mean, Mexico is way the hell down there, and you're in here, and that's the way it is.
Yeah, right. That's the way it is. It's down there, and I'm in here. I guess it comes down to a simple choice, really. Get busy living, or get busy dying.
So King is often pigeonholed as a horror writer, but really he's so much more than that, isn't he?
Yeah, he really is. I mean, we could go through the various subgenres that are connected to King's work besides horror. We could also talk about the way in which he works the Western traditions in novels like The Dark Tower. But speaking of that clip that you just played, is there anyone writing in America today who writes better about prisons than Stephen King? Even a novel like a novella like The Mist, which is set in a supermarket during an apocalyptic storm, is a prison. And prisons are everywhere in Stephen King. Sometimes they're self-made, but they're everywhere in his work.
So I want to ask you about adaptations because
sure.
So much of Stephen King's work has been turned into movies and miniseries. I want to play something from the opening scene from the 2017 It Chapter One. 6-year-old Georgie first meets Pennywise, played by Bill Skarsgård, when his boat floats into a sewer.
Do you want a balloon tour, Georgie?
I'm not supposed to take stuff from strangers.
Oh, well, I'm Pennywise the Dancing Clown. Pennywise? Yes, meet Georgie. Georgie, meet Pennywise. Now we aren't strangers, are we?
Pennywise, the source of so many adult fears of clowns that last through their entire life.
Oh, boy. Stay clear of that clown, Georgie.
It is a movie that made $700 million at the box office. Do you agree with folks that say we're in a renaissance of King's work? You had Pet Sematary came out in the spring. You got the miniseries Castle Rock, The Dark Tower. It Chapter 2 is obviously coming out tomorrow. Do you agree with that, or do you think that there's always been a constant interest?
We've never left Stephen King, and he's never left us. It's just that sometimes there's an ebb and sometimes there's a flow. And right now, we're in a flood. And it's coming in, you know, in these films like Pet Sematary and It. It needed a readaptation. The first one wasn't sufficient. It wasn't good enough. I think this one's much better.
Well, you're not the only fan of It Chapter One. Stephen King himself was a fan of that remake. He recently did an interview with Movie Clips and talked about what he thought made it so successful.
One of the things that I wanted to do in the novel, in all of my novels, is to create characters who were fundamentally decent, by and large. And that way, you don't want them to be spam in a cabin. You know, you don't want them wiped out. You want them to live and you want them to win. And I think that that translates to the film.
I'm curious. I was reading one critic who says he believes that King has become more optimistic in his later years. Do you think that that's true, or do you think that that's always been there buried under the kind of slash gore horror stuff?
Oh, yeah. Well, there's always been the sentimental Steve. Steve can't let the kid die in Cujo. And I guess I just want to disagree with Mr. King respectfully. Please, could I emphasize the word respectfully? I don't think it's those fundamentally good characters are what draws people to It in particular. I think it's Pennywise. I think we're drawn to Pennywise in all of his various manifestations because we're fascinated with evil. We're living in a time of utter chaos, really, especially in this country. And what Steve is doing is essentially tapping in to those anxieties and fears that are part of postmodern America.
So I want to play a cut from another recent remake. This is 2019's Pet Sematary. It stars Jason Clarke as Dr. Lewis Creed. So this is a scene where he's reintroducing his wife named Rachel to their daughter who had died but now is returned home reanimated.
There's a place, Rach, deep in the woods beyond the Pet Sematary. It brings things back.
Aren't you happy, Mommy?
Rachel!
She doesn't want me here.
No. Mommy just needs time.
It's okay. I don't want her here either.
This is one of King's darker works.
Yeah.
Pet Sematary didn't quite get the same box office success of It. I'm wondering why have some not been as successful as others?
Well, it's tapping into some sort of primal fear, I think. Maybe it's the John Wayne Gacy fear of clowns that all adults have. Maybe it's the idea of a town that's turned inside out. And Pet Sematary, you know, if we come back to that first question you asked me, Chris, about King's literary legacy, you can't have Pet Sematary without Hawthorne. You know, the great Massachusetts writer who wrote stories about going into the woods and being transformed. In America, we didn't have haunted houses. We didn't have Gothic castles. So Hawthorne had to rely on the woods. And King's borrowing heavily, I think, from that transcendent element that so often appears in Hawthorne. And anyone who has an appreciation for New England is going to see that those woods are scary, dark, and deep. I mean, Robert Frost saw that. And where King takes us in a story like Pet Sematary is into a place where the woods are not only dark and deep, but also capable of changing us, transforming us, as they do inexorably in Hawthorne.
So you've talked a lot about writers and works that influence King. I'm curious how you see King's influence on current pop culture. I know when I'm watching something like Stranger Things, I can't help but think this is an extension of Stephen King's work.
King has been such an influence on American culture that I think the only way you can connect it is with people like the Beatles. So if you think you've got a whole generation of writers that have been brought up on Stephen King, a steady diet of Stephen King. But I also think you have a whole genre of cinema that has been the result of King's involvement. Stranger Things, you've already mentioned, but the whole horror tradition that has been produced since, I think, the slasher films in the 70s owes something to Steve. There's something about what he's producing in his fiction that is connecting to the anxieties and the fears of a contemporary American culture. He's also producing hope. There's a great tradition of hope in King's work, and hope is a good thing, and no good thing ever dies, right?
That's Tony Magistrale. He's an English and film professor at the University of Vermont. He's also written 4 books on King's works, the latest of which is The Shawshank Experience, tracking the history of the world's favorite movie. Tony, thanks so much.
Thank you, Chris. It was a pleasure talking to you.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman. Tim Skoog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Chris Siderek. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.